Hi, I'm Femi OK. Today on the stream, I'm joined by three Al Jazeera journalists from across the globe to discuss the stories that they're covering. And we want to hear from you. If you are in our live YouTube chat, you can talk to correspondents who bring us the news. Leave a comment or a question, but you'll have to be really quick because this is going to be a fast-moving show. So, our first stop is Europe, where the standoff continues between Ukraine and Russia. Al Jazeera's Hoda Abdulhamid reports from eastern Ukraine.
In the winter sea, the landscape at the front line of this conflict seems frozen in time. The Ukrainian army is entrenched just a few kilometers north of Donetsk, the stronghold of Russian-backed separatists. The enemy is not far away.
70 to 100 meters. So they can hear us too.
Okay, let's go.
The army has moved into what is left of the industrial area on the outskirts of Avdiivka. The conflict also seems to be frozen in time, neither side making gains since the war broke out in 2014.
Hoda, it's so good to have you on the stream. It's almost like we've lifted you straight off a news bulletin and then bang into the stream. What I would love to do in our chat is to take us really behind the front lines in Ukraine and tell us how Ukrainians are viewing this. Is it a crisis? Is it a crisis for them?
Well, actually, Femi, today with the team, we were chatting and we were saying we've got yet to meet a Ukrainian who says, I'm really worried that there's going to be a Russian invasion. They just shrug it off. The one sentence you always hear people saying is that we've been living with the threat of a Russian invasion for the past 8 years. We've been hearing all about it. And then they seem also much more in touch with reality. Many would tell you just, you know, the conditions are not there. It's winter, the sub-zero temperatures, the ground is frozen. The Russians don't have enough troops on the other side of the border to invade. So really, it's a completely different tone than what you hear then from, you know, political leaders, presidents, all that sort of hype that you hear. Nothing on the streets, neither in Kiev or here in eastern Ukraine, where people actually live near the front line and do hear, you know, gunshots, do hear explosions once in a while. They're completely shrugging it off.
Yeah, I remember watching one of your reports recently, which was on the front line. So an area where a lot of people had left, a lot of Ukrainians had left, very close to where the Russian troops were actually standing by on the border. And a couple of gunshots went off from across the border, breaking the ceasefire. And the gentleman, your soldier you were talking to, he sort of wandered off. You wandered off in the other direction. Nobody looked panicked.
Absolutely not. We just stood there a few minutes to wait if there was going to be a few more gunshots and to understand in which direction. And then we just continued our shooting. And I did ask, is that the enemy? And they said, yes. And I said, does that happen all the time? And they said, yes, it does happen all the time, but it's okay. Mm-hmm. They didn't seem worried at all. And I did ask the soldiers, do you personally think there's going to be a war? And the ones I spoke to, at least, I didn't speak to everyone, but they also said, no, we don't think it will be at this particular moment in time.
That's fascinating, getting that sort of first-hand knowledge from soldiers who are waiting to see what might happen. I want to bring in Yulia. Yulia is from Human Rights Watch. Have a listen to the video that she sent us a little bit earlier, Hoda, and then respond off the back of it.
At Human Rights Watch, we have been following the situation unfolding around Ukraine in recent weeks and months with growing concern. But as concerns continue to grow about the threat of a possible large-scale military offensive on Russia's part, it is important to remember that Ukraine has been at war with Russia for nearly 8 years, ever since Russia occupied Crimean Peninsula in 2014. The plight of civilians in eastern Ukraine who have suffered enormously from the beginning of this conflict, who have had their homes, their hospitals, their schools damaged or destroyed, should be on everyone's mind as we continue to monitor this current escalation in Ukraine.
Well, I think she hit it on the nail there. I mean, that's what a lot of people told me here. We've been 8 years at war. This is not something new. It's been ongoing, and we know that at some point there will be an escalation, not yet now. And then, yes, there is a humanitarian situation. I mean, it's not a terrible humanitarian situation because a lot of people have moved cities, have gone to other areas. But can... Is the connection still there? I'm sorry. Yeah, I think it broke down, the connection.
It did break down. Just pick up where you left off, because we were looking at some of your reporting footage, so you didn't leave us hanging. Go ahead, Hoda. Please keep talking.
Okay, so...
We've lost the connection. It may well be the temperature where Hoda is right now. If you've been watching her doing her live hits, her reporting during the news, you would have seen how much bundled up she was and how frigid and cold it was. I see her. Hoda, you're back again. Can you tell us the story that you're going to report on next, just before I wrap up, because I don't think the internet gods will be in our favour for much longer. Go ahead, Hoda.
Well, actually, today we went, there's this contact line. It's 420 kilometres long, and there's plenty of little villages along that contact line. Mm-hmm. And I have to say they're empty. They're part of a military zone, but the government did allow residents to go back. There's just a few people left. So you do get a feeling there that obviously people don't feel safe to return to their homes and are living in other areas. But, you know, I spoke to an old lady. She was walking around with her husband. And I said, what are you doing here? Why don't you leave? And she said, well, this is my home. This is where I grew up. And I said, what happens if there's a war? She said, we have a small shelter at home. I'll just go down in the shelter. And it's quite incredible to see people who... I really don't panic at this particular moment in time. What I did notice, however, is that behind the scenes, there's a lot of stories of torn families. Because at the end of the day, the link between Ukraine and Russia, especially in this part of the country, mm-hmm. is very deep. People speak Russians in this part of the country. And I met several people who told me that they're considered the enemy by the rest of their family. One woman in Advievka told me that her cousins and uncles and aunts live in Donetsk, which is the stronghold of the sort of Russian-backed separatists, yeah. And they decided to stay there, and now they call her a traitor. So you do have a lot of torn families, and I think that's something that the country will take a long time to recover from.
Thank you so much, Hoda, for taking us behind the scenes of your reporting that you're doing right now in eastern Ukraine. We really appreciate that. We will continue to follow you on Al Jazeera. We head further east to Beijing, where the 2022 Winter Olympics opening ceremony is next Friday. Al Jazeera's Katrina Yu reports on the excitement and final preparations.
These slopes are full of avid skiers and snowboarders. Many are looking forward to the games.
Of course, I am very excited and proud because the Winter Olympics will be held in my motherland.
It makes me very happy. These sports have become very popular in China in recent years.
The Chinese government has poured billions of dollars into preparing to host the games in February, including investing in Italian snowmaking equipment to help build up its fledgling winter sports industry.
Katrina, so nice to see you. Thank you for your reporting that you've been doing. There has been so much politics involved in the Beijing Winter Olympics that we forget sometimes that it's about snow sports, winter sports, skiing, snowboarding, all of the amazing things that happen in the wintertime if you live in a cold climate. How much excitement is there on the ground?
Hi, Femi. Well, there's a great deal. I guess if you ask Chinese authorities, they would say they're 100% ready to host the Winter Olympics. They've taken this backwater, remote, mountainous village and in a matter of years turned it into a winter sports center with brand new infrastructure built up from nothing, basically. And China itself had a very fledgling winter sports industry. There weren't that many people relative to other countries who were into winter sports, and now you've got millions really engaging and at an advanced level in these games and these sports. You've got, you know, when it comes to the other things that are prepared, you've got the mascots ready, the medals designed, the uniforms, hundreds of staff ready and waiting to prepare the games. So there is a lot of momentum. China's been waiting for this big grand moment. It's going to be Beijing is the first city that's going to host both the summer and the winter games. So yes, there is a lot of excitement there. I think that's definitely the story that the Chinese government want to tell. Of course, there's the other thing, is the stuff that is not going to plan according to Beijing, and that is when you look at things like the coronavirus outbreak, and you also look at a lot of international criticism, which is attracting the wrong kind of attention in China's eyes.
Let me ask you about the snow. Not technical details about the snow, but is there snow? And I'm going to do that via some of our stream family who spoke to us a little bit earlier about their concerns about snow, which is sort of a 101 for hosting the Winter Olympics. This is what they told us.
Beijing is a location that has very high temperatures. There is almost no snowfall in the last couple of years. And the specific location where these games are taking place have only seen an average of 21 centimeters of snowfall per year in the last years.
So all the snow has to be produced artificially. This requires huge amounts of water in an environment that's not appropriate for snowmaking because it's very arid and very windy, and the water has to be brought from very far away. So all in all, these games are not sustainable.
So, Katrina, I'm just wondering, is there not a winter sports culture in China because of the lack of snow in places where it's needed in order for that industry to thrive?
That's definitely a big part of it. Like you heard in those comments, this is a very dry part of the country, and it doesn't get a lot of natural snow. It's winter here, it's -5, -10 degrees in the city, but we rarely see snow because it's just simply too dry. I did go to those areas, and I actually spoke to the manufacturer of all the snow machines who will be providing those facilities for the Winter Olympics. His argument was that, look, it's not a problem. A lot of world-class snow facilities do use artificial snow, and actually it can be beneficial when it comes to the sport, because you can control the texture of the snow, the amount of snow, you can really get it perfect in terms of how you want it to be for the slopes. But of course, many aren't really buying that argument, because when it comes to climate change, when it comes to the environment, a lot is going into producing the artificial environment, the artificial conditions for the Winter Olympics to go ahead.
You touched on a little bit earlier some of the other concerns that have become headlines during the lead up to the Winter Games. Again, some of our community pointed out those concerns. So I'm going to bring them up and we can address them one by one. COVID and then politics. Let's take a look.
When it comes to COVID, China has prided itself on having a zero COVID approach. But with the Olympic Village there, and even though it's being managed under a closed-loop management system, if there's any virus outbreak from the village into the broader population in China, that will be politically embarrassing.
Certainly, a lot of groups in the West, political and non-state, have raised questions about human rights violations happening in China and suggested that the Olympics should either be boycotted or a site for protest. So it will be very interesting to see how tolerant Chinese authorities will be if there are, in fact, athletes using the Olympic platform to engage in protest.
Externally, there is considerable anti-China sentiment and scrutiny. And if we think about, for example, the Uyghur community and Xinjiang province, also the Peng Shuai case, that will keep coming back for China, I think, to challenge how people see the country.
Katrina, let's start with COVID, because when Beijing originally bid for the Winter Games, this was long before we had any idea that COVID would bring us a pandemic. And now it's a major winter sporting event in a situation where people gathering together to enjoy sports, it's going to be very difficult, maybe impossible. Is zero COVID spread Is that possible? How is that being addressed?
That's right. So in China, one case of the coronavirus is one case too many. And so we've seen in the broader community, if there's, just a few cases identified, you've got mass testing, quarantining, lockdowns in many cases, and all in the effort to get that number back to zero. And it really inhibits this freedom of movement. Now, China, even coming up to the third year of the pandemic, has come under a lot of criticism for this approach. A lot of people saying, look, this is not sustainable. China cannot just isolate itself from the world. So it wanted to use the Olympics as kind of this proof that this zero tolerance policy is working and it can be sustained. And that is what the Winter Olympics was really supposed to show. But of course, now you've got this an outbreak that's happening around the country. It's even reached the capital itself, Omicron and Delta. Chinese authorities have really gone through a lot of painstaking effort to make sure that everyone going into the Winter Olympics bubble will be basically sealed off from the rest of the country. You've got here in Beijing these special Winter Olympics lanes, so people coming from the airport will go straight into the bubble. They've warned the public that, for example, if people in these buses, if the bus breaks down, nobody approach the bus like normal police and normal hospital staff.
Katrina,
are not allowed to approach the buses just in case they get infected.
We will find out if this works. We only have to wait 7 days. We're going to find out if this actually works. I have a question for you very quickly. This question comes from Blazic. Blazic is watching right now, and the comment is, China should be getting sanctioned, not being celebrated or being rewarded with the Olympics. That obviously is a question and a comment that comes from outside of China. What would be the response from within China?
The Chinese government is working really hard to control the narrative inside China. It's censoring information. And what it's putting out to the Chinese public is that there are only a handful of countries determined to contain China, jealous of China's achievements. And they're ruining this moment for China by boycotting the Olympics. But that's not going to affect the success of the actual games. But then what this does is it really stifles and creates no space for any discussion around the validity of these criticisms, these accusations of human rights abuses and even genocide around the treatment of the Uyghurs, for example. So that's what's happening inside China, but very much so outside of China. You're seeing this international criticism that is really tarnishing China's image. It's really, this is supposed to be China's moment to show the world that it's not only a strong country, but it's an influential one. And this is really undermining its credibility because a lot of countries now are very careful about how they deal with China. A lot of sponsors, multinational companies are very wary about showing their sponsorship or their relationship or support of the games or Beijing. So it's almost two worlds. So it will be really interesting to see when the game starts, when you've got all these thousands of participants coming from all over the world, not used to the amount of censorship, not used to this control of information, not used to being silenced when it comes to their opinions about criticizing the Chinese government, going into China, and you've got these worlds colliding. So it'll be interesting to see if these athletes do kick up a stink in Beijing's eyes and express their opinions that are not in line with what the Communist Party wants the Winter Olympics to be about. It will be interesting to see how Beijing does respond, because so far its response has been very a blanket response of, we don't want to politicize sports.
There shouldn't be any sports
and they
in
haven't
politics.
Really much more information.
Yeah, I hear you. But sport and politics go together like, I don't know, peanut butter and jelly, fish and chips. So that is going to be an impossible mission. But I cannot wait to see what will happen. February the 4th is when the Winter Olympics begin. And we know we're going to be seeing Katrina Yu on Al Jazeera a lot in the next couple of weeks. But for now, thank you, Katrina, very much. So our final stop is the US state of Hawaii, where the lack of affordable housing is deeply felt by the indigenous Hawaiian community. Here's AJ Plus producer Julia Moldavin with that story.
I've never been homeless before. This is my first time. Sometimes I feel no matter how hard you try, there's always a barrier.
here in Hawaii.
Native Hawaiians are being priced out of Hawaii.
No way could I afford to even live here, just me alone. And that's the sad part of it. We can't afford to be here.
Hawaii is the most expensive state to live in the U.S. And out-of-state buyers continue to turn housing units into vacation rentals or second homes. As tourists flock to the state's resorts, golf courses, and beaches, local residents are facing a housing affordability crisis.
They want $1 million for places. This is Maui. It's not like you can drive to another island.
Rent is also increasing, and salaries are not keeping up with the rising cost of living.
Julia, so good to have you here on the stream. Can you tell us how you found this story? Because we all have an image of Hawaii, this tropical paradise. And then to have indigenous people of Hawaii not being able to find homes, not being able to afford homes in their own land, that is shocking. How did you get that story?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I agree with you that it is shocking. The story is carried out in different places in the U.S. and the world. But I actually was going to Maui to do some other stormwater right thing to be coming today. But I'm hearing this thing over and again where people just talked about housing affordability. So I was talking to dozens and dozens of people around this other story that I was working on, and more and more people told me, oh, no, if I didn't have a paycheck, if I didn't have this next paycheck, I wouldn't be able to stay on this island. And something about that just kind of struck a chord with me, because Hawaii is so far from the U.S. and a state in 1959. And so when these people, they are kicked the island, they move some miles.
So Julia, so, I'm just going to pause us for a moment because your audio is not fantastic. So we're going to fix the audio. But in the meantime, I'm going to bring in somebody who you met who talked about the challenge of being a Hawaiian, an indigenous Hawaiian, and not being able to afford a home without all of the family piling in. This is Carol Lee Kamakon.
These homes can run about $850 and up to a mil. Not because of the houses and the way they look, because of the location of the houses. Is that affordable for a Kanaka Maoli? No. Not even if you're working three jobs with two incomes in the household. So that's why Kanaka Maoli have a lot of multi-generational homes where you have two, three, possibly even four generations living in one household, just so that we could survive and live here at home.
So Julia's documentary is very short. It's like a mini documentary. It's only 8 minutes long. I'm going to show you here on YouTube where you can see it, because then you'll get the full story. It's called Why Can't Hawaiians Afford to Live in Hawaii? Why can't Hawaiians afford to live in Hawaii? There are solutions. There are solutions from local authorities who are working out how do we give land to indigenous Hawaiians. There is a list, but that list takes a really long time to get on that list. I want to bring in somebody that we talked to earlier to get us a better idea of how you solve this problem. Her name is Catherine Monet.
If we are truly serious about addressing this issue, the state of Hawaii and the federal government would get creative about ways to bring more affordable housing to bear and pairing that housing with the services and supports that may be needed by anyone in a culturally relevant and competent way, such that we can truly have a state of people where everyone thrives.
Julia, there should be a solution to this problem. When you were reporting it, what did you come up with?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It's also a very big question. I think that there are a lot of experts that are working on this, and there are a lot of policies that people are working on, including, you know, trying to put caps on Airbnbs and vacation rentals and condos, and limiting the number of homes that out-of-state buyers can own, putting on, you know, a certain amount of percentage of affordable housing units in every new development. I think the issue is that there is this kind of patchwork of policies, and there's still people that are falling through the cracks. Right. You know, like we saw with Carolee Kamakona and Jessica, a lot of the times it's a lack of resources, a lack of access to knowledge about those resources, which was partially what was happening in Jessica's case, is right. not having those available.
Thank you so much, Julia, for sharing your story with us. Have a look here on my laptop. We have three Al Jazeera reporters on today's show. Here we go. We had Hoda Abdul Hamid. Julia Moldavin, we just heard from Julia. And of course, Katrina Yu. Thanks for watching. See you next time.